Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I'll take a 64-ounce soda pop, please, with extra fructose, if you would, just because I can. Mayor Bloomberg's soda ban has lost round one. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 11th of March. And those of you within the five boroughs of the greatest city in the world, go right ahead and belly up to the soda bar, would you? New York's proposed ban on big sugary drinks was struck down this afternoon, enjoined and permanently restrained in the legal vernacular. In business terms, you could say head fake or bait and switch, because you got a plan when a staple of your beverage menu is threatened, don't you? Freda Resnick is a marketing manager at Frames. It is a bowling lounge and bar, it calls itself, in Manhattan. Freda, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You guys were all set for this ban to happen, and then the judge kind of changed your mind, didn't he?
Yes, you know, it was kind of frustrating for New York businesses who are trying to, you know, keep the law and then keep their heads above water by being one step ahead. But you know what? New Yorkers are resilient, so we just bounce back.
You guys will figure it out. What did you have in mind? How were you going to deal with this proposed ban then on the big sugary drinks?
You know, like any other restaurant in New York, we do offer pitchers of soda. And our general manager saw this as an opportunity to say, you know, let's be the first one to offer alternatives to the soda. Let's start offering freshly squeezed juice options, citrus blends with carrots and mango and mint, and then other blends of like apple, cranberry, beet.
So what does beet juice taste like? Have you tasted one of those things?
It's actually really sweet and flavorful, believe it or not. I mean, it would be infused with something else, such as, you know, apple. Apple beet has always been something popular with a little cinnamon stick. It's quite good. And I think that having alternatives to soda means that people might choose that over soda.
Now, do you get to charge more for the juices? What does an 8-ounce juice cost me?
So generally, I think the juices will have to start at a higher price point. They haven't been determined yet, but at least a dollar or two more than the average cost of a soda.
So what'll that be? If a soda is a, what? Well, it's Manhattan,
the sodas
right?
are about $2.50 a pint glass.
Yeah.
So the juices will generally have to start at about probably between $4 and $6 a glass.
Well, yeah, I mean, I get that Manhattan's Manhattan, but if I'm taking my 9-year-old bowling, I'm not paying $6 for a glass of beet juice.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that the reason why people would opt for the soda over anything else, you know, the reason why restaurants are excited to serve soda to begin with is because of the potential markup.
Sure, sure.
But if the potential markup is there with the juice as well, I mean, restaurants can offer this as an alternative and pass on the savings to the customer.
Yeah, now you are bringing back the pitchers of soda, right?
The pitchers of soda will still be available as long as we are allowed to sell them.
Yeah.
But, of course, you know, everybody wins if somebody purchases a juice.
Freda Resnick, she is the marketing manager at Frames. It's a bowling lounge in Manhattan, New York City. Freda, thanks a bunch. See ya.
Thank you so much.
This will not be, as you might have guessed already, the last word on this whole thing. The mayor's office has already said it's going to appeal this ruling. On Wall Street this Monday, not so much carbonated as just a continuing gentle fizz. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We are now 10 days into the budget cuts, and the government is still running. Soldiers and sailors still have ammunition and fuel and food. But decisions are being made at the Pentagon about what to pay for and what not to pay for. Both the Army and the Marine Corps have decided they are not going to be taking any new applications for a program that offers tuition assistance to active duty soldiers. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Last year, more than 500,000 active duty service members got tuition assistance to go to school at night, to take classes online. Gordon Adams teaches foreign policy at American University.
They can both get a degree and do their active service at the same time.
Adams says this is a popular program, and in the context of the whole Pentagon budget, it's not that expensive. All branches of the military spent just $500 million on tuition assistance last year. But Larry Korb says it's an attention grabber. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. It's the kind of cut that leads constituents to call Congress.
Wait a second, these kids who've sacrificed so much for us, you mean you're going to, you know, prevent them from, going to school?
This won't affect service members who are currently getting tuition benefits, but it's sure to affect many of the schools they're enrolled in, especially for-profit colleges and universities. Last year, more than two-thirds of these benefits paid for so-called distance learning classes. The recommendation to freeze tuition benefits came from the Secretary of Defense's budget advisor. Commander Leslie Hullride is a Defense Department spokesperson.
Under sequestration, we've got to cut roughly $46 billion. That's about 9% from every defense account except for military personnel funding.
The Navy and the Air Force say they'll make announcements on their own tuition assistance program soon. In the meantime, the Army says it'll consider reinstating the benefits for active duty soldiers if the budget situation improves. To be clear, these cuts don't affect veterans. The GI Bill, a much larger program, is sequester-proof. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
InTrade is no more, or at least it's got some really big problems. It was one of those sites you might remember that let you bet on future events like the presidential election or who the next pope is going to be. Yesterday, the Dublin-based website stopped trading, saying only on its website that there were, quote, circumstances that required them to freeze pretty much everything. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports now the impact of all that could extend well beyond just account holders.
Thank you for calling InTrade. We're not able to take your call right now, but please leave us a detailed message after the tone, including your name and account username, and we'll get back to you as soon as possible.
You can bet that as soon as possible is going to be a while. You just can't make that bet on InTrade. The company isn't staffing its phones. It's not paying out account holders. And it's not going to be delivering the data that professors and pundits love so much. Eric Zitzewitz is an economics professor at Dartmouth.
I think it's a big loss.
InTrade and its highly specialized markets were good source material.
InTrade was the most used prediction market for wagers, if you will, on topics of academic interest.
From the elections to the war in Iraq to the future of the euro, it was all there on InTrade to discuss and dissect. Justin Wolfers at the University of Michigan says InTrade was also important for pundits. It helped keep them honest.
Previously, you could just wear your leather elbow patches, smoke a pipe, and appear on PBS or CBS or any TV show saying any old thing.
But he says just because InTrade is gone doesn't mean we're back to a world of fact-free jabber. InTrade, he says, was the leading face of an important idea.
That broad crowds have a lot of information, and that markets are an effective way of aggregating that information, and they often turn out to be much better than experts.
And with other sites doing similar things, he says, it's an idea that's not going away. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
We bring you now to the curious intersection between the federal budget debate and American life expectancy. We're all living longer, and like everything else, our golden years bring with them some costs. For the government, that comes in the form of Social Security and Medicare benefits. But rolling back those programs seems to affect rich and poor unequally, which gets us back to life expectancy, as Marketplace's Sally Herships explains.
We're living longer to the age of 78 on average, so why not start collecting Social Security benefits just a little bit later?
That's a seductive thought.
Eric Kingston teaches social work at Syracuse University. He says, before we start tinkering with our benefits, remember, Congress already raised the eligibility age by 2 years back in the 80s.
And so we're already cutting benefit for anyone born after 1959.
Kingston says Congress found delaying full benefits until the age of 67 would hurt almost a third of Americans. Now, he says, making the eligibility age even older will hit the poor the hardest, because while the wealthy are living longer, guess who is not?
Those on the lower end, the lower half of the income distribution, their life expectancies have stagnated and some have actually even reversed.
Maya Rockymore is president of consulting firm Global Policy Solutions. She says the change would mean the poor get a shorter retirement than the rich.
When you have people who disproportionately die at younger ages, their contributions to Social Security actually go to subsidize the retirement of people who are longer lived and higher income.
And as for the argument that since we're living longer, we can work longer, Eric Kingson says that also depends on your income. The wealthier you are, the better chance you have to choose how long to keep working. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Think about this the next time you shoo your kid off the couch and tell him to turn off the Wii or the PlayStation. Video games are a $70 billion industry, a mass market global business force, to be sure. But does that make them art? Turns out for a number of mainstream museums, the answer is you betcha. From graphics to the computer code to the interaction between humans and machines, digital games add up to modern design. And conveniently, showcasing them could add up to museum revenue, as Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports.
Headphones are hardly unusual at the Museum of Modern Art. You can use them to hear the audio tour or experience a piece of video art. But when you pick up the headphones now installed on the museum's third floor, you'll hear something brand new to MoMA. That would be Pac-Man gobbling his way through a maze seen on a TV set inside a gray wall. And despite my best efforts on the joystick, him getting caught by a ghost. Pac-Man is one of 14 video games now on display at MoMA. Attentive ears will recognize video game music piped into the gallery. There are popular titles like Tetris and lesser-known works, gifts to the museum from their designers and game companies. MoMA finds them aesthetically compelling, culturally relevant, and innovative enough to be included, along with Ames chairs and Frank Lloyd Wright windows. Senior curator Paola Antonelli explains part of why MoMA now has video games in its design collection.
You move in time when you're in the screen, and the combination of time and space is the sense of moving architecture.
She says MoMA's avoiding violent games because the collection recognizes constructive design, not destruction. MoMA joins the Smithsonian as another newcomer that sees games as art. Antonelli admits the art and design establishment has been slow to embrace gaming.
It's our fault. You know, we take a little while to catch up, but it's about time and it's a natural move.
That move could bring some new visitors to the museum's design floor, which can get overlooked by crowds on their way to the Van Gogh or Cezanne masterpieces upstairs. Jamin Warren is founder of Killscreen, a gaming culture magazine. MoMA consulted him and others as it built its collection. Exhibiting games is one way to get more young visitors through the door.
They rely on donations and they rely on visitors. And what better way to get a new generation of people interested in the life of a museum than to start talking the language that they're talking?
The Museum of the Moving Image in New York is fluent in that language. Games have appeared alongside film and television almost since its 1988 opening. Plenty of visitors in their 20s were there for a recent exhibition on five decades of video game history. Younger people like Celia Vargas and James Rodriguez, who dropped tokens in Space Invaders, one of many games on display in a gym-sized room.
But you had to fire, though.
No! Totally cheating.
The perception of video games as mere youthful diversions is one reason the generally older people who run museums have taken so long to accept them. Also, some dismissed video games as commerce, not art.
Get over it.
Museum of the Moving Image Executive Director Carl Goodman.
For us, that's the sweet spot when a work can be tremendously influential and successful and also artistically relevant.
I'm traveling in space and trying to kill...
At his museum's exhibition, Megan Burns is blasting her way through the geometric patterns of the 1981 arcade game Tempest. She designs websites and apps. For her, more museums taking gaming seriously means more opportunities for inspiration.
It's always great to kind of revisit the roots and explore different ways how people have done it in the past and how we can kind of change it for now.
How increased artistic credibility changes video games remains to be seen. For gaming journalist Jamin Warren, what matters is how game creators respond.
That battle about whether or not games are art is over, but the challenge over the next decade will be to create the types of things that are worthy of a place in the museum.
Film, architecture, photography, all of these were once outsiders looking in at an art world dominated by painting and sculpture. Like it or not, video games, too, are now inside the castle walls. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up, shopping after Fukushima means thinking twice at the grocery store.
With things that aren't supposed to be there, like cesium, even if it's under the limit, it's there. And you never know what the effect will be if it accumulates.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose a third of 1% today, 50 points, closed at 14,447. The NASDAQ added a quarter percent, that is 8 points, 3252. The S&P 500 rang up one third of 1%, 5 points, 1556 at the bell. Financial stocks went along for the ride. Citigroup bounced up nearly 2%. Bank of America rose by two-thirds of 1%. J.P. Morgan Chase ran up 0.5%. Morgan Stanley added 0.3%. Today, Ford Motor Company drove up nearly 2.8% today on increased deliveries to China. Boeing climbed up more than 2% on reports that it plans to ask its board to okay sales of an improved version of the 777 as early as April. Apple started down but rallied up, taking on 1.4% today. Dell rose 1.5% after reaching an agreement with Carl Icahn, who has opposed the buyout plans of Michael Dell, the company's founder. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.06%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its monthly job openings and labor turnover survey. On March 12, 1933, Americans tuned in to hear the first of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's fireside chats during the Great Depression. And singer-songwriter James Taylor turned 65. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is much to get distracted by at South by Southwest this week, the Polyglot Interactive Film and Music Festival that's taken over Austin, Texas. There are more bands than you can shake a stick at, film screenings galore, a tennis court-sized model of the next space telescope, should you be so inclined. But there is big business being done during the technology-focused part of the festival as well. And one way to follow the money is to keep an eye on the people who have it, the venture capitalists trying to blend in with the techies. Marketplace's David Brancaccio reports now from Austin.
Check out Dave. He's outside one of the less glamorous South by Southwest hotels, nursing a morning coffee. He's dressed just as you'd expect for a venture capitalist.
I'm wearing some flip-flops from Brazil that a friend of mine gave me, shorts and a t-shirt. After this, I'm going to go try and survive a game of basketball with a bunch of other geeks.
Dave McClure of the firm 500 Startups makes modest investments, as little as $50,000 at a time, in a company's really early stages.
The basic strategy is we make a lot of little bets. We expect probably anywhere from 50 to 80% of them to fail, and then hopefully the top 20% or more turn into something interesting.
McClure says he's at South By to keep his eyes open and to make friends. The money comes later. Contrast McClure with Patrick Chung. He's with venture capital heavyweight NEA. Its offices are at the center of the VC universe in Menlo Park, California. Chung's got a full-on suite at his Austin hotel, and unlike Dave there, is wearing actual shoes. What's a non-grunge guy like him doing at this indie extravaganza?
There are over 20,000 people who are high-energy, entrepreneurial, tech-savvy people, and the whole lifeblood of our business is to become enmeshed in communities of extraordinary talent. And that's why we're here.
And there's Jules Maltz from International Venture Partners, who's throwing a party at the Tony Driscoll Hotel later that evening. Don't show him a nice but untested startup idea. Maltz works for a firm that writes checks from $10 million to $500 million.
And so really our specialty is that later stage of a startup, not the two people and a dog type of startup. A lot of great venture investors are good at that. We're great helping companies scale.
IVP has put big money on some companies that are big brands now, including the cloud storage company Dropbox and a short message sharing service that made its first splash at South by Southwest 6 years ago. Goes by the name of Twitter. From Austin, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
A quick look at the calendar today, March the 11th. is innocuous enough for most of us. In Japan, though, it's become 311, shorthand for the tsunami and nuclear disaster at Fukushima 2 years ago. Tens of thousands of people still can't go home, might not ever be able to, actually. People are still missing, and fears of radioactive contamination are still very much present, especially in the food supply. The government in Tokyo insists things are safe, that they're testing. But Catherine Winter reports now from Tokyo that eating and shopping habits are changing nonetheless.
David Wagner has lived in Japan for almost 30 years. He loves Japanese food, but these days he gets groceries at a store that sells imported foods.
So I buy my granola here, and the reason I'll take this is from Germany.
Wagner doesn't want to leave Japan. He's got good work here as a business communication consultant. But after the nuclear accident, he started a Facebook page on food safety. He stopped eating mushrooms because they absorb radiation. If he wants fish, here in the land of sushi, he mail orders it, canned.
I just do not eat the fish in Japan anymore. They can't test all the fish.
Fish is still popular in Japanese restaurants and groceries, but uncertainty about food is widespread among the Japanese. Some people even use private testing services. Customers come to this Tokyo shop for organic cotton towels and hand-dipped candles, and also to use the radiation detectors. There are two of them in the back.
This is our detectors. Every day we are testing.
Hidetaki Ishimaru set up shop here after the disaster, checking food for radiation at 3,000 yen a test, about $32. Samples fill a shelf.
Brown rice, soybeans, white rice. That is seaweed, I think.
The Japanese government says the country's rice is safe, but customer Yuki Yanagase is skeptical. Ishimaru translates for her.
I don't believe it, so I'm gathering many information from internet.
The internet's full of scientific studies and conspiracy theories about radiation, what you might expect when a danger is invisible and hard to understand. If your job is to try to explain things to the public, good luck. Dr. Shuichiro Hayashi works on crisis management for the Food Safety Division of the Japanese Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare. Hayashi says after 311, Japan set such strict limits for radiation that you could eat food contaminated at that level every day and be just fine. Japan allows much less radiation in food than the U.S. or Europe. His colleague in the Ministry of Agriculture, Mitsuhiro Doishita, says the government tested 10 million bags of rice from Fukushima in 2012, and only 71 were over the limit. Many people told me they're reassured by these measures. Wakako Yamane is an interpreter at an ad agency, stopping by McDonald's for coffee before work. She was worried about food right after the accident.
Today, I'm not concerned at all, actually. Some people are. I'm not. I just want to continue the way we've been living, and I think we're all right.
This may be a case of what David Wagner calls radiation fatigue. He says you get tired of being vigilant about food. When we had lunch one day, he had a salad, something he wouldn't have done a year ago. But he wasn't sure he should.
And from everything I read, nobody can say definitively or non-definitively that it's safe or not safe. That's what's confusing for people like me.
Research about radiation is confusing. A new World Health Organization report on the Fukushima disaster says people are not at risk of health effects unless they were in the most contaminated areas. But the report acknowledges the limits of the research it relies on. Studies tend to look at people with higher levels of exposure, such as atomic bomb survivors. The long-term effects of low-level exposure are not as well known. So some people figure, why take a chance? On yourself, maybe. But what if you have kids? 2-year-old Carrera Tani demonstrates the English he's learning in kindergarten. The Tani family lives in Chiba, near Tokyo. When the nuclear plant, 130 miles away, started spewing radiation, they fled to Osaka. They're back now, but they buy drinking water from Hawaii. They use a grocery delivery service that tests food for radiation. Carrera's mom, Momo Tani, is a doctor. She says the high grocery bill is worth it for her son's health.
Well, with things that aren't supposed to be there, like cesium, even if it's under the limit, it's there. And you never know what the effect will be if it accumulates.
Tani worries about the research that shows children are particularly vulnerable to exposure to radiation. A lot of parents told me they aren't concerned about their own diets, but they're careful about what their kids eat. Many of them told me they feel bad for not supporting the farmers in the disaster region, but they're buying their rice from Kyushu, far away from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. For Burn, I'm Catherine Winter for Marketplace.
Catherine Winter is a reporter for Burn, an energy journal from Sound Vision Productions with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which, as I think you'll see, has a distinct keeping the workers happy theme to it. Next time you're feeling sleepy on the job, not unusual this time of year with the whole daylight saving time thing, go ahead and consider a nap. Researchers point out a 20-minute nap can give a big boost to productivity. In fact, some companies are actually setting up rooms just so you can grab a quick snooze. So go ahead. Also, about what I said on Friday, no, I'm not leaving. You kidding me? I did get the big boss to agree to beer cart Friday, though, so it worked out all right. All right, we're done. That's Market, and I won't do it anymore, I promise. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow rose a third of 1%, 50 points. The NASDAQ added a quarter percent, 8 points. The S&P 500 rang up a third percent, 5 points. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Gina Delvac, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Miller Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Julie Podokas, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.